How do you know about the Hanassans? What? You're the only one who gets to know things? They were my favorite as a kid. Used to make my mom tell me stories about them every night. He considered this a moment, then shook his head. Even if they could help me, which they can't, they wouldn't want to. We'll be in port all day, Blaze snorted. What else are you going to do? Dress those little rats of yours up in bonnets and booties? Dante laughed, flushing. Once the bad tidings had completed the rather tedious process of nosing up to the deep water docks and tying off, he clambered down the ladder and made for town. He knew very little about the Hukkolians other than that they rarely left their homeland. They favored fur hats from the skin of a biskin, a ferocious bear-like predator that, as far as Dante knew, didn't actually exist, and it was virtually impossible to tell whether they were serious or pulling your leg. He couldn't even trust the directions to Serini Temple he got from a local stevedore. Walk up the mountain until you can't walk anymore. Just in case the stories of the Biskins were true, he took his sword with him, but left Blaze and the others behind. This mission had the feel of a pilgrimage, or an embarrassment, and either way it was best faced alone. The streets were paved with broad slabs of basalt, with irregular sides, but which fit together with minimal cracks between, as if they'd all been snapped off from the same massive table of stone. Live shedwind lined the paths to most houses, their straight green shoots 8 feet tall. The road climbed a rolling hill. Behind him, the sails of the bad tidings gleamed white against the glittering grey sea. The town and the pavement ceased abruptly. Round stone farmhouses stood off the dirt road. Fields of green and brown stretched for half a mile or more. At their borders, dark firs rose in a towering kudzu. Ahead, the road led straight to the tallest of three modest mountains with white-painted peaks. The nearest mountain was banded with alternating shades of green. Dante saw why, an hour later. With the ground rising beneath him, the madly hissing forest that had swallowed the path suddenly vanished in favor of motionless fields of shedwind. A couple hundred yards later, the forest resumed, only to cease just as abruptly for more shedwind, some ways past that. Meanwhile, waist-high stone dogs bracketed the road at the border of each change. They had the straight spine and pricked ears of the watchdog of Menok, but the statue's ears were decidedly foxy, their tails flaring and puffy. The eyes were simply hollows in the stone, but their sockets counted in a cunning expression, which made no sense at all. Menok was as somber as it got, his distanced gloom untouched and unaffected no matter how chaotic the earth or heavens became. The fox of Carvajal, meanwhile, lived to cause trouble, to play gods and humans against each other in any combination. He'd probably trick the trees if he could. Combining these two icons into one watching, laughing canine was either blasphemous or an incomprehensible joke. The alternating bands of firs and shedwind continued for 4 or 5 miles. Just when Dante thought the path would never end, it did. A flat and grassy plateau abutted a sheer black cliff. Crumbled basalt slumped against the cliff face. The road branched 4 ways, leading to 4 caves set into the vertical stone. 30 yards ahead, a man stood across the path, dressed in furry leggings and several layers of jackets. So, you made it. Is this it? Dante said. The temple? You were expecting lofty spires? The man said without smiling. Delicate stained glass that paints the floor in rainbows. In truth, Dante had expected something quite like it. Are you waiting here for me? Anyone who'd walk up a mountain must have an interesting question. What if he doesn't? Then it is fun to laugh at him. The man touched his blonde beard. What is your question? Dante went as still as the shed wind. What was his question? He couldn't flat out ask about the mysteries of the loon. If its secrets got out, their entire advantage would be nullified, leaving them to face the armies of Gask with nothing but inferior numbers and prayer. Anyway, what would this cave-dweller know about the Nether, of bending it to form artifacts that could outlast an age? The man tipped back his head, as if reading Dante's mind. You came all this way without knowing your question. Maybe it's too complicated to pose simply. Maybe you're too simple to make it simple. Dante tightened his jaw. What do you know about the Nether?
Whatever it allows me.
Nice dodge. Has anyone who knows what they're talking about ever fallen for it? The man stuck out his hands at arm's length, face contorted in revulsion. Black slime dripped from his fingers, pattering soundlessly on the dirt path and evaporating like water on a griddle. The viscous slime climbed his forearms, swallowing his elbows and then his shoulders. As it slithered up his neck and began to form a black mask, the man went motionless and smiled like a painting. The Nether disappeared.
Oops, he said.
I spoke too fast, Dante said. But that display was awfully fast itself. My problem lies in making such things last.
A lasting mark.
The man nodded.
The concern of every young man.
And likely every young woman, too.
But they hide it better.
If the Nether comes from my hands, how do I make it stay once I take my hands away? The man tipped his forehead forward, frowning.
You think the Nether comes from your hands?
Dante blinked. That's not what I meant.
Strange, because that is what you said.
Well, where do you think it comes from?
Me?
The man looked genuinely surprised.
Oh, I believe I'm a Ron in human skin. I have yet to be proven wrong.
Do you know how to get it to stick to a thing?
This is no longer interesting.
The blonde man nodded downhill.
I think you belong back there.
Already? But I came all this way. The man raised a brow.
It really isn't that far, you wimp. Now move, for I have praying to do.
Wind gusted through the plateau, stinging Dante's eyes with grit. The man didn't seem to notice. Dante waited for several awkward seconds, then turned and started back down the banded mountain. In town, he found Blaze ensconced in a bench recessed into the floor of a tavern just past the docks. Blaze smiled over a stein of Cavern, so heavily spiced it must have been brewed locally. Well, he sipped. How'd it go? Dante shook his head.
I think he made fun of me.
Is that it? Blaze said. I could have done that right here and saved you the trip. By the time they finished at the pub, Dante had a hard time climbing the wooden ladder back to the ship. In the cabin, Mourne snored on the bunk across the room, his hairy shins jutting from the edge of the bed. Blaze banged through the door and flopped into bed with his boots still on. His phlegmy breathing soon joined Mourne's. Dante hated the oracular speech of monks and priests. If you used enough vagaries and poetry, you could make anything sound profound. The wise man heavies his plate with eggs, for the wisdom of the unborn is unbound by perspective. Either the blonde man knew how to help him, and should have said so explicitly, or he didn't, and should have been equally explicit about that. No wonder so little ever changed. When people weren't lying outright, they peddled half-truths and obscurities. Next morning, Blaze woke with a scowl.
He slung his feet off his bunk and crinkled his face.
Did I step in something?
He squinted at the soles of his feet.
Did I sleep in something? Just yourself, Dante said.
When Blaze left for breakfast, Dante quickly took his satchel of rats next door, confirmed Lyra was out, then occupied her cabin to chop up the rodents' bodies, clean out their skulls, and dump everything else into the sea. He spent all morning and afternoon with the Nether, saturating the fresh bones with shadows that melted away the moment he turned his mind elsewhere. How could he possibly convince it to stay? If it was a spirit, an essence of the thing to which it was attached, how could he force it to stick to an object it didn't embody?
Sunset bathed the cabin red. He left Lyra's room for his first meal of the day. He intended to return to his work, but Morn asked for a game of Nulladoon, and as he wavered, three other sailors eating at the table goaded him to accept the challenge. Morn's play was careful and thorough. In the end, his last pebble was too strong for Dante's original orange seed. By the time they dissected the game over two beers apiece, Dante was too tired to even think about Nether or bones or cryptic monks. That left him 2 days until Narashtovik. 2 days to find something to bring to Kali's door besides apologies and empty hands. He paused mid-stride on his way to the plank that served as the head. Empty hands. Empty hands he filled with Nether. Was that what the monk had meant with his question about the Nether's source? Because his hands weren't quite empty, they possessed a drop of Nether themselves. If he honed his focus like the point of a pen, he could draw the substance from his palms like a line of ink. If he then spent it, it returned in the next hour or day, didn't it? There was a reason he felt drained from practice and refreshed with rest. It was no different from the way his physical strength wore away and then returned. Presumably, any object that contained Nether would regenerate it, or rediscover it, with enough time. Heart thumping, he spread out his assortment of bones. He sucked Nether from the walls and himself, spinning it into the veiny network that connected him to the dead rat's dormant senses. And then, with all the care of a hobbyist mounting a butterfly, or a traveling barber pricking the cataract in the eye of a patient, he drew the droplets of Nether from the bone itself, and used them to smooth a tight sheath around the shadows he'd drawn from himself. He held his breath. If he could have, he would have held his heartbeat. Gently as sleep, he removed his focus from the pair of loons. The veins and their sheaths stayed in place. For a minute, Dante did nothing but watch. Nothing changed. Nothing faded or slipped away into the crevices it had been called from. At times, the sheath glimmered darkly, as if rippling under a pale moon, but Dante saw no movements of any other kind, and detached from the loons, he couldn't feel them, either. Not with his mind, anyway. The two loons lay on an old cloth on the floor. He touched the nearer one as cautiously as if it had just been plucked from a boiling pot. He felt nothing but bone. He lifted it to his ear. Heard nothing but the dumb hiss of a cupped seashell. He brought it to his mouth, paused to think, and said, I don't, said the loon still resting on the cloth. Dante sprawled back, banging his spine into the side of the bunk. He crumpled forward in pain. Several seconds later, when he was fit to walk again, he snatched up the second loon, burst from the cabin, and plowed through the neighboring door. Blaze sat straight up, bedsheets flapping, and pawed at the recessed shelf beside his bed, rattling his scabbards. "I've got it," Dante said. Blaze glowered, face puffy. "Unless,"
it is an unstoppable fire or a giant hole in the floor. You can tell me about it later.
Take this. Dante pushed one of the loons at Blaze's groggy face.
What is this? It looks like a bunch of bones wrapped up in string.
It is. Now, stay there. Dante ran back outside and slammed the door, drawing a stare from Lyra, seated a short ways down the hall. He ducked into her room, closed the door, and brought the loon to his mouth. Blaze Buckler prefers the company of aquatic mammals.
Holy shit!
Blaze's voice piped from the bundle of bone in Dante's hand, followed by a painfully loud clatter. Something hard scraped against wood.
Are you dropping my priceless artifact? Dante said. No, I mean, it talked. I mean, you get hard from dolphins.
I will now be accepting nominations for sainthood of me.
That requires proof of godly ancestry, Blaze said through the loon. No more than 4 generations removed, if you can trust my mom.
The door to Lyra's cabin jarred open. Blaze wandered inside, still speaking into the loon held in front of his mouth.
Which I do, because she also told me I was the handsomest boy in Malin.
Close the damn door, Dante said, hustling to do just that. So, there now exists the non-zero chance Callie won't use us to mulch his garden. Blaze turned the bundle of bone and string over in his hand.
I'll admit this is impressive. Not impressive enough to redeem yourself for sparking a war, but probably impressive enough to get you off the hook if you'd slept with his sister.
Callie's sister would be 100 years old, and no doubt bearded, but hunger turns stones into soup.
Once I had the idea, it really wasn't that hard to piece together.
Dante reached for the other loon, holding one up in each palm. It's based on the same principle I used to delve into the senses of dead animals. Through forming 2 such linked pairs, then splicing those pairs together, you more or less have the basis for a functional loon. Except only I can use it, because I'm the only one with an ethereal link. If I then go on, however, to exploit the object's own inborn nether to support the structure instead of using my external focus to do so, it turns out that...
Fascinating, Blaze said. Now shut up and let's tell the others. Except, not like that, unless you're sick of them and want them bored to death.
Dante glanced at the closed door. I need to ask Morn a few questions. I don't think Lyra needs to know, though.
Why not?
Because I don't really trust her.
Blaze raised his brows.
Of course not. It's not as if she's pledged her life to you.
I pledge to serve you bacon shaped to spell your name every morning so long as we both shall live.
Dante bowed. He straightened and met Blaze's eyes.
Guess who's going to be deeply disappointed tomorrow morning?
Come on. She's been nothing but trustable. She could have turned us into Cassander's people any time in the last week.
Dante took another look at the door. Unless she's holding out for an even bigger reward for bringing them a working loon.
Fine, she gets to know nothing, Blaze said, but only because it's a genuine war secret.
Dante went to fetch Morn and found him wave-watching from the bow. Empty grey waters rolled to the eastern horizon. To the south, far white hills slept under new and gleaming snow. A steady wind assaulted Dante's ears. One of the crew struggled with the rigging of the mainmast. Atop the stern, another 2 argued with the rotund captain. The deck was otherwise clear. In the isolation, Dante gave Morn a quick demonstration of his loons.
I can hear the wind coming out of both of them, Morn said after a moment. The clan's loon spoke directly into your ear, and only when someone had something to say.
Well, I'm not done.
Dante wrapped the bones in cloth and tucked them away.
I just wanted to see what you thought.
Why would you want my opinion? I didn't have anything to do with making them. The only reason I know about them is because I had the privilege of being born into the clan of the 9 Pines. I may as well build a castle and ask that gull over there what it thinks.
Dante frowned out to sea. I think we should rename you... Cheer. He wanted to construct a second set of loons, and confirm his success with the first wasn't some confusing fluke. But he still wasn't sure what would come of the first. Besides, despite having sailed for several days, he'd spent less than an hour with the ocean. So he sat down beside Mourne, legs folded, and watched the incoming swells, the subtle tilt of the horizon as the bad tidings climbed each watery hill and slid down the other side. Waves hissed and splattered. A cold and constant wind grazed his face and forced its fingers past his collar. He reached his mind out towards the pair of loons every 2 or 3 minutes, unable to stop himself despite knowing there would be little or nothing he could do if the delicate nether sheaths began to crack. Still, this ceaseless double-checking reassured him, releasing a growing pressure that began in his head and slowly filled his gut. An hour later, he checked the loons and found the nether was gone. He brought one to his mouth and spoke. He heard nothing but his own voice. The nether had simply disappeared, reducing the loons to inert matter. He returned to Lyra's cabin and assembled another functional pair, but an hour later, it too reverted to dumb, simple bone. He tried again, watching the third set without interruption. A little over an hour later, shining white cracks appeared in its shadowy sheath. The cracks thickened, little by little. Without warning, the black case burst apart. The trapped nether that linked the bones together dispersed at once, absorbing into the rag and floor beneath the loon. Nothing he tried that day made any difference. He stayed up late and woke early. His head was heavy, but he forced himself to get up, wash his face, and return to work. Something strange had happened with the broken loons. The droplets of internal nether he'd used to form their sheaths had returned, but were unshaped. He took that nether and reforged it into fresh sheaths, wrapping these around new globs of nether drawn from foreign sources. An hour later, however, the sheaths collapsed again. Dante fell back on the cot, exhausted. What good was a loon that could only last an hour? Late that morning, bells and shouts yanked him from his labor. Narashtovic grew on the horizon. Within hours, he'd be brought before Kali and held accountable for setting off the war. Chapter 8. Not long ago, Narashtovic had been called the Dead City. It was known as such even among its own citizens, what few remained, anyway. No one thought anything of the ghastly appellation. That was simply its name, earned through centuries of warfare and sackings that had reduced the city's outer rings to crumbling ruins. For those who stayed, it was a home. No more and no less, and while it was true that you could find ribs and skulls if you chose to poke through the fallow houses on its fringes, life at the core of the city was still normal enough. Things had changed since Samaran's aborted war against Malan some 6 years ago. The pine forests that infiltrated the city's old borders had disappeared, cleared for timber and tilled for crops. Fresh-cut wooden homes replaced most of the old stone ruins. The rasp of saws was like steady breathing, the rap of hammers, a heartbeat. To the north, a high green hill considered the city, the site of the cemetery where Larimore was buried. Past the outermost homes, the pride gate circled Narashtovic's interior. Further yet, the inn gate that surrounded Narashtovic's oldest quarters was hidden behind steep black roofs, but at the city's very center, the staggering spire of the Cathedral of Ivars punctured the sky. Beside it, the keep of the sealed citadel rose like an upthrust fist. As far as Dante had a home, Narashtovic was his. He hadn't seen Bressel since before the war, and anyway, he'd hardly lived there a handful of weeks. Before that, he spent his childhood and middle teen years in a farming village in Malan's breadbasket, Memories of his youth were a golden haze of streams and fields. Since leaving, he rarely thought of it. Because, in a way, he had been the midwife to Narashtivik's rebirth. He'd helped put down Samaran's holy war on Malon. The refugees and survivors of that aborted conflict flocked to time-withered Narashtivik, making their claims on half-ruined homes that had lain empty for generations. When he wasn't busy on council business or one of Callie's endless errands, Dante enjoyed exploring those abandoned homes. They felt secret, sacred. Yet he'd been happier to see new families make them their own. Between the chimney smoke and fresh fields, it was clear the city had swelled all the more in the 2-3 years he and Blaze had spent arming, supplying, and scouting the Norrin territories. Dante had missed that growth, that bustle, the knowledge he could step out into the street and see or buy or experience whatever he wished. So he was worried about Callie's reaction to their news, and fearful of whatever fate might befall the city in the next months or years. But he was also glad, plainly and rightly, to be home. "Think it still stinks?" Blaze said beside him on the deck of the Bad Tidings. "Absolutely. Figure out those things of yours." Absently, Dante touched the cracked bones in his pocket. "Not by half. Well, we're still a ways out. Plenty of time to finalize your will." "It's not going to be that bad. Maybe he hasn't even heard." "You're leaving me all your stuff, right?" Blaze said. "Because I'm going to say you are anyway." There was no point in a last gasp scramble to perfect the loons. Dante was simply out of ideas. Instead, he descended to his cabin, nodding to the scurrying sailors below decks, and packed up his spare clothes and blanket and the cracked skulls of the rats. Back above decks, the Bad Tidings slipped past the western banks of the bay, where a thicket of grounded ships rested in the silt where the river met the sea. There, an impromptu neighborhood had assembled among the racks. The ship's sails were long gone, the bronze and iron stripped from figureheads and railings. Instead, clean white laundry flapped from masts. Residents jogged across planks nailed between half-submerged decks. Improbably, smoke curled from more than one of the grounded cabins. Slant-walled shacks clung to masts and forecastles. The last time Dante had seen the bay, the old ships had been completely uninhabited, their hulls crusty with salt, gulls piping from rotten rigging. "I almost hate to make port," Mart said behind him, startling him. "We're bound to pick up some new rats." "So, you're happy with the outcome of our arrangement?" Dante said.
"Happy? We'll have the only shit-free barley in all of Garsk."
"You must be very proud."
"I've got half a mind to press-gang you."
Mart's eyes glittered above his beard.
"But then the sensible half suggests my body would wind up piled with the rats."
The boat came to port, and sailors debarked to tire off. Over the last few weeks, Dante had become so familiar with the process, he could have pitched right in. By the time the crew secured the gangway to the dock, a crowd of longshoremen, merchants' aides, and would-be travelers had gathered at the base of the pier, babbling and jostling, breath visible in the harsh light bouncing off the sea. A queue of carriages idled in the open square beyond the waterfront, but Dante decided to walk. No need to hustle to his fate. Few Norrin lived in Narashtivik, and Morn drew more than one look as their group thumped down the damp pier toward the waiting crowd. His hulking presence was enough to open a gap in the throng. Dante led the way, composing his route to the sealed citadel. Candon Street would be the shortest, but it was the first day of thaws, and the main streets would likely be clogged with a plague of potters, tailors, and shoppers, all looking to— Metal flashed from the forest of fur coats. A short man plunged from the crowd, knife darting forward, his gaze locked on Dante's chest.
Too late, Dante grabbed at the nether, his panic whipping it into a charcoal froth. The man's arm straightened, preparing to drive the blade home. Lyra flung herself forward, ramming her shoulder into the man's ribs. They thudded to the boardwalk, hands locked together, grappling for the knife. Lyra rolled the small man onto his back and flicked her fingers at his eyes. As he flinched, she clamped both hands on his knife hand and twisted his wrist toward his body, bearing down hard. The man screamed. His wrist gave with a fleshy pop. Blaze's sword snaked past Lyra and speared the attacker through the left lung. The retreat of the crowd left Dante in the middle of an empty circle. He stood there, shaking, as pink blood burbled from the attacker's mouth, the man's broken wrist flapping against the boardwalk. Blaze pulled his blade from the dying man's ribs with a wet shoop. "I didn't think Callie would be that mad." Jittery fury flooded Dante's veins. He knelt beside the assassin and grabbed him by the collar, yanking his head from the pier. "Who hired you?" The man blinked, glassy-eyed, and coughed thickly. Dante shoved him down by the collar, banging the back of his head into the planks. "Was it Cassander? All you have to do is nod." The assassin choked, coughing bubbly pink blood over Dante's heavy coat. He fell back, spasming, fish-like. "He looks pretty dumb to me," Blaze said. "Let's ask his pockets instead." He crouched on the other side of the body and turned out the pockets of the man's cloak and doublet and trousers, revealing three more knives, one long and two small, a handkerchief, a plain leather purse clinking with coins, a bag of dried venison and cherries, a sewing kit, comb and scissors, and a pinky-thin vial of a viscous black-brown liquid. Boots jogged the planks. Two armed men hurried down the pier, dressed in the black leather and silver trim of the city. They stopped cold when they saw the body. Drawing swords, they shuffled forward, right feet extended. Blaze pocketed the vial. Dante stood, sleeves foamy with blood. "This man attacked us." The guards' faces were drawn with angry caution. On seeing Dante, the expression of the man on the right shifted to relieved recognition. "Are you all right, my lord?" "I'm fine." Dante nodded to the knife Lyra had knocked down the planks. "Be careful with his blade. It may be poisoned." Another pair of guards arrived to handle the crowds and the corpse. The first pair led Dante and crew through the holiday-busied streets to the nearest guard station, a tight-quartered space inside one of the three-story towers that rose at intervals from the Pride Gate. There, Dante answered questions, which he mostly ducked. He'd pass his suspicions about Cassander along to Callie during his dressing down, and waited around for a half hour until yet another guard arrived to inform Dante and Blaze their presence was required at the sealed citadel. As if fearing they'd attempt to flee, this latest guard accompanied them from the tower into the rising hills beyond the Pride Gate. Children wove through the crowds, their dark hair threaded with grassy crowns. Men stopped at public houses while their wives eyed bright fabric and bought pies stuffed with the first and hardiest harvests, frost peas, Gascon squash, turnips. Most of the buildings here had been occupied and maintained even during Narashtivik's leanest times, and showed little of the recent patching and reconstruction that dominated the structures beyond the outer wall. Stone gargoyles guarded the rooftop gutters, silently judging the boisterous humans below. "Thank you," Dante said to Lyra. It was the first moment of semi-privacy they'd had since the attack. "I suppose that makes us even." She shrugged, gazing across the revelers. "An action done in the name of duty is never the equal of one taken freely." He gave her a long and skeptical look. "Are you talking about snagging you from that boat? We did that to find out where the bloody knuckles had gone. Saving you for information is no different than saving me because of some crazy debt." "What if I walk away, and you're killed 5 minutes from now? My debt wouldn't look so repaid then." It's no fair if you keep changing the rules. They passed under an arch of the inn gate, a second ring of solid stone, which had separated nobles and well-landed merchants from the decay that beset the city for so long. Inside, the streets were rather more subdued. Families strolled together between the bright tarps, shading the stalls and carts gathered at every intersection and plaza. Dante could have differentiated the traders past the inn-gate from those outside it, even without the fine dress and casual pace of their clientele. Outside the inn-gate, carts were piled high with cloth and toys. Inside it, velvet-topped displays held a bare sprinkle of goods, a half-dozen rings, say, gleaming amidst the empty space of their surroundings. A wide stone avenue climbed the city's central hill. The endless shadow of the cathedral fell over Dante's face. Across from that, a towering citadel gazed down from behind its unscratched walls. Dante wore none of the trappings of his station, but before he could introduce himself at the sealed citadel's iron gate, it raised with a series of heavy clanks.
"What? They don't even ask your name?" Blaze said as they crossed into the courtyard. "If I'd arrived by myself, I'd be waiting until the walls fell down."
Gant waited just inside the courtyard, pale enough to look as though he walked between sunbeams and narrow-shouldered enough for Dante to believe he did just that. The majordomo bowed, back curved in that particular Narashtivik fashion.
"My lord Dante, it's been too long."
"I know, Gant," Dante said. "Hello, and goodbye." Gant tilted his face.
"Goodbye?
Figured I'd better say it now since Callie's about to murder me. Is he up in his chambers?"
"I believe so. And I don't believe he will murder you, my lord, no matter what you've done this time."
"Oh, I don't know." He gestured to Lyra and Morn. "I've got two guests, as you can see. Will you find lodgings for them?"
"At once."
Gant bowed and bobbed his head in a fashion that perfectly intimated Morn and Lyra should follow him up the stairs into the keep. Dante followed too, but as Gant swept the others through the quiet foyer on his way to the guest rooms at the rear, Dante and Blaze curled up the main stairwell instead.
"Well?" Blaze said, the single word echoing up the stone steps.
"Well," Dante agreed.
"You don't really think he could?"
"No, I don't think so. Callie's a tyrant, but generally not a violent one."
"That's a relief," Blaze said. "Except for the fact that means we have no idea who just tried to kill you."
Dante saved the rest of his breath for the stairs. Callie kept his quarters at the very top of the keep. Dante had no idea how the old man managed to climb up and down the stairs all day long. It probably involved demons. Big ones. At last they reached the upper landing. A black carpet striped the hall. Tapestries illustrated and insulated the walls, weavings of Aron at his mill, and the starry arrangement of the heavens. Callie's double doors were closed but unlocked. As Dante opened the door, a wintry breeze knifed from the open balcony and cut past his face. Dante's boots sunk into the cushy black rug. The woman to occupy the room prior to Callie had busied it with pious marks of her station as High Priestess of Aron. Holy books, candlesticks, intricately illuminated parchments, and silver statues of the White Tree. On moving in, years back, Callie had hollered, "Look out below!" from the balcony, and then flung most of the room's contents straight out the window. Now his chambers most closely resembled a scribe's den. Bookshelves along both walls, black grenados of ink gleaming from the door-sized desk, great nests of parchment and quills, and quill snips and jars of white blotting sand. That left the room center quite empty. So, too, was the stuffed red chair at the far end of the room. The fireplace was cold and dark.
"Suppose he's invisible," Blaze said.
"No, I suppose he's quite visible, in a place that isn't here."
Dante left to track down a steward. The third man he found knew where Cali was, among the ruins on the outskirts of town, but balked at leading them there until Dante reminded him that dusting the mantles was several rungs less important than a direct order from a member of the Council of Narashtovic. After that, the man led them back downstairs and into the streets in a southerly course. Past the Pride Gate, as many houses were ruined as intact. Many lots were nothing but snow, grass, and mounded stone. Twice, explosions boomed through the ruins further to the south. "That's him, isn't it?" Dante said. The servant didn't glance over.
"I couldn't possibly say, my lord."
"That's definitely him," Blaze said. The steward led them into a patchwork field of snow and grass. One wall of a farmhouse stood between a slew of old stones and rotten timbers. Beside it, a solid chimney rose 30 feet into the sky, freestanding and intact. The servant led them toward its massive hearth. The ground around it was scorched. The cold wind stirred the scent of something burnt and sharp. A hinged door of iron had been bolted to the base of the chimney. It was also scorched.
"My lords," the steward said.
"Yes," Dante said.
"I have taken you to Callimandicus. May I return to the citadel now?"
Blaze knelt and touched the patina of charcoal around the chimney.
"Ye gods, we're too late. He's burned himself to hell."
Two skinny legs thrust from the entrance to the chimney, wrinkled and bare. They were accompanied by a muffled, echoing voice.
"Who goes there?"
"A confused person," Dante said.
"Two confused people," Blaze said.
"Oh," the voice said. "You two."
The legs kicked, toenails scraping soot from the chimney walls. Ash sifted to the blasted ground at the chimney's base. The old man tumbled to the ground with a grunt. Cali blinked at them in the overcast sunlight, soot smearing his cheeks and his tangled beard. Between the black of the ash and the white of his beard, his eyes gleamed from his cheeks like captured sky. His bare legs sprawled, liver-spotted and hairless. A long shirt draped past his loins.
"What happened to your pants?" Blaze said.
"My..."
Cali glanced down at his legs.
"Oh, lost those about an hour ago."
"Doing what?" Dante said. "Or is that a question I should leave in peace?"
"Doing this."
Cali collected himself from the fireplace, careful not to bang his head on the brick of the overhanging hearth, and padded to a cart parked halfway across the field. There, he loaded a wheelbarrow with two sacks, one small and shifting, with something like sand, the other big, clanky, and bulging with what sounded like crockery.
"Wheel this over for me, would you? Crawling up chimneys is hard work."
Dante muttered and leaned into the wheelbarrow. Back at the chimney, Cali tossed the small sack into the soot at its base, then gestured at the bag of dishes.
"Get those out and pile them up, would you?"
Dante tore open the sack, which was, indeed, full of dishes, and began placing them atop the smaller bag, stirring fine clouds of choking dust. He dropped his third handful, shattering crockery over the brickwork. He swore.
"No matter."
Cali flapped his hand, as if to wave away the dust.
"It'll all be like that in a moment."
Dante shrugged and returned, with considerably more roughness, to loading up the dishes. Cali swung the iron door closed and clamped it shut with several locks, sealing the hearth. He batted cinders from his beard.
"You might want to step back, unless you would prefer to be flung back instead."
Cali turned and ran, shirt tails flapping. Dante and Blaze followed. Some 50 feet from the towering chimney, Cali hunkered down in the snowy grass. Nether roiled around his hands. His tongue poked from the corner of his mouth. Shadows flowed in a river from his hands, gushing under the iron door and disappearing into the chimney. A tremendous
bang rattled the chimney, the door, and Dante's teeth. Black smoke plumed from its mouth. An upward hail of crockery vomited into the sky. "Thames, virgin daughter!" Dante hollered. Callie chortled, pointing at the soaring debris. "You see?" "Very good," Blaze said, rubbing his ear. "You've discovered the world's worst way to clean a chimney." Dante goggled up at the tumbling specks. "What was in the other sack?" Callie shrugged his bony shoulders. "Dried urine, black sand, a few other things. That just gives it an extra shove. Most of the force came from the nether." "What happens when it comes down?" "Oh, yes. Well, we should probably run again before that happens." Callie took his own advice, dashing across the field with considerable speed for his advanced age. A stand of pines flanked the dilapidated farmland. Before they'd crossed half the distance to the shield of trees, jagged flecks of dishes rained down to earth, pattering the snow and plinking from stones. Callie flung his arms over his head and laughed. Dante reached the pines and hunkered under the branches to catch his breath. Black smog drifted south on the bay-berthed wind. "What's all this about? A crusade against crockery? Imagine if you aimed that chimney at, say, 30 degrees. Callie sketched its angle through the air. "What if you fired it at a formation of enemy troops, or a fortress's walls?" "How much nether does it take?" "Lots. A lot of lots." "Why not aim the nether directly at the enemy instead? A lot fewer things can go wrong then." Callie rolled his eyes in disgust. "Except if they have sorcerers of their own. Then they snap their fingers, and your big ball of nether fizzles away like dandelion seeds in the gale. But I suppose you didn't think of that."
"I suppose I didn't.
Anyway, this is just the theoretical stage. A perfected model would be much more effective." He clapped his knobby hands. "Want to fire it again?"
"Yes, but we need to talk first."
Dante blew into his hands.
"Listen, have you heard about what happened?"
Callie's white brows shot up. "That you burned down the ancestral manor of Cassander of Beckenridge, and he's going to talk the king into declaring war on us? Why the fuck do you think I'm out here blowing stuff up?"
Dante laughed hollowly.
"Oh, his highest kingship, Lord Modigan, has already levied a new estate tax, you know. It's enough to think he plans to pay for several thousand men to march across several hundred miles."
"It's his fault," Blaze pointed at Dante. "He was chasing down the infamous Quivering Bow."
Dante whirled.
"What the hell?"
"What? You'd rather he hear it from someone else?"
"I was going to ease him into it."
"How were you going to ease me into explaining that?" Callie snarled. He drew himself to his full gangly height, his elbows as swollen as the gut of a freshly fed snake. Beneath the soot, his hair and beard hadn't been combed in days or cut in months.
"Well, did you find it, or did you get diverted by a herd of snipes?"
"Regrettably," Dante said, "we discovered that it doesn't exist."
"Do you know what you've done?"
"I thought it could win the war before it began. We made contact with the clan of the Nine Pines. They promised it was real."
Callie ran his hands down his snarled white beard. His eyes were closed, as if he were weathering a cramp. "Within the next few weeks, the king is going to issue an ultimatum. It's going to be outrageous, possibly so much that the Northern Territories, if they accept, will wish they'd simply gone to war instead."
"I thought war was the plan all along."
"Years from now, when we were ready, when our position would be so strong, even the clowns in Setevan would rather let the Norren go than try to march against them."
Dante stared at the grass. Beetles crawled between the blades.
"I thought I could help."
"The Norren won't back down from this. Not all of them. They're too fractured."
Cali turned away from the city. Bitter wind whipped his beard. People are going to die, Dante. I found something else instead. Something... Cali raised his splayed palms to his shoulders. The council meets tonight. The issue, to put it indelicately, is whether Narashtavik will stand with the Norren or abandon them to the warhounds of Gask. Dante cocked his head. How did they know I'd be back today? They didn't. As it turns out, the world goes on without you. Try to make it a better place for once. Callie's weary disappointment stung worse than any wrath. There was too much to say, so Dante said nothing. In time, they returned to the citadel together, wordless the whole way. Pantsless and begrimed as Callie was, the gatekeepers still recognized him. Dante supposed it wasn't the first time they'd seen him in such a state. That could have been worse, Blaze said once they were alone in the stairwell. Oh, really? Dante said. We could be dead. Dante gazed at the musty walls. I think I'd rather be. Maimed, then? Weighed down by a brick of guilt and two broken legs? Pain would be a welcome distraction. Blaze grabbed Dante's shoulder, jarring him. Will you knock off the self-pity? This thing has hardly begun. What do we do to de-disaster it? We have no choice. Dante lifted his face. We have to help the Norren. We're the ones who got them into this mess. Great, so quit moping and figure out what you'll say to the council. I'll go get the molten silver. Molten silver? To pour on your tongue. Dante shook his head. A floor down, he discovered his long vacant room had recently been cleaned. The bedsheet smelled like soap and the pine needles the servants pestled to scent the linens. There was no fire, of course, and it was too cold to take off his cloak, but he left his door shut and locked. For the moment, he needed isolation. In time, he belled a servant for a bath, which he sat in until the water grew lukewarm, letting the slow work of water wear the salt and dirt from his skin. He shaved and dressed himself in the council's colors, then faced himself in the small mirror above his basin. His jaw and cheeks had gone harder. Suggestions had become definitions. Under normal circumstances, he was the type to plot out every word of what he might say at the meeting, to sketch the branch of every argument he could make or anticipate facing. Instead, he closed his eyes and opened his inner sight to the nether, watching it trickle through the room's dark places, its minute pools under his bed and dresser, its shining dust glittering from every surface. A servant knocked. It was time. Dante returned to the upper floor and made for the council's chambers. The cherrywood double doors bore the image of the white tree of Barden, ghastly and beautiful, its trunk and limbs fused from spines and ribs, molars and canines forming its flowers and thorns. Inside, a long, plain table dominated the room. Sectioned glass windows overlooked the vivid pink sunset on the bay. Dante was among the last to arrive. Old Tarkin was already seated, his cane leaned against the table. He winked Dante's way, heavy wrinkles bunching around his eyes. Hart sat too, a mountain of a Norren with thick clouds of beard swirling about his head. Ollivander's head was bent in apparent prayer, muscly soldier's shoulders bunched around his neck. Joseph's ancient eyes were closed. He may have been asleep. These were the lone survivors of Kali's uprising beneath the boughs of Barden. Some of the dead had been replaced within days. Wiry Cav, whose carved features betrayed his noble birth but not his age, which must have been passing 60. Ulev, chubby, a simple monk raised above his station. Maria, the old woman whose blue tongue would better suit a stevedore than one of her arms chosen. Somber, quick-eyed and twitchy, his brown skin and elusive accent a product of one of the Southern Isles. Varla, who spoke as rarely as an oracle. The last to arrive, besides Callie, whose habitual lateness was more a product of indifference than a conscious display of his station, was Wint, who, in his mid-thirties, was the youngest councilman besides Dante himself. Assorted servants orbited the table, too. Behind Dante's right shoulder, Blaze leaned against the wall. Callie ambled into the room, and the council rose as one.
"Excellent," Callie said, seating himself. "I can't remember the last time we didn't have at least one empty chair."
Tarkon pursed his lips, ruffling his beard.
"Then again, you can't remember the last time you emptied your bowels, either."
"Nonsense. On matters of importance, my scribe takes the strictest notes."
Callie's smirk faded.
"I'm not going to rehash every detail. If you're not up to date, it's your own damn fault. In short, a clan of Norrin burned Lord Cassander's estate to the foundations. In response, King Modigan has levied a new tax. He's begun headcounts in Bonn and Latover. Headcounts means troop counts. Troop counts mean we'd better grab our balls and run for the hills."
"The debacle with Cassander was my fault," Dante broke in. "We led a clan on a mission to rescue their enslaved cousins. Things turned violent."
Wint lifted a thin, black brow. "I heard the search for a few missing Norrin was just one of the reasons you were there."
From behind Dante, Blaze snorted.
"Of course it was. Do you think we'd cartwheeled through some lord's door, torches in hand, all for the sake of a single clan?" "It doesn't matter why it happened," Callie said, cutting off any potential objections to lowly Blaze speaking out of turn. "What matters is what course we take from here. If none of you want to figure that out, my next course is straight to bed."
The other members glanced between each other. A servant coughed. Ollivander leaned forward and clasped his heavy hands on the table.
"If Modigan marches, it will be on the Norrin, not us."
"Sounds like the very reason we should stay clear," Wint said.
"They're counting on our loyalty."
Somber's head jerked back and forth.
"Since when is suicide the best expression of loyalty? We preserve ourselves, stash our loyalty away, then return it to the table when it's actually worth playing."
Tarkon rolled his eyes.
"Would that be before or after the Norrin territories are converted into the world's largest charcoal bed?"
"I've met Modigan," Cav said in his academy-honed tones. "He doesn't believe in half measures. If we throw our sticks in with the Norrin, he'll burn us without blinking."
Callie grimaced.
"Ollivander, what kind of numbers can we muster? Reliably, I mean. You military men seem cursed with double vision whenever you survey the troops."
3,000, the big man shrugged. "A tenth that in cavalry. Between the last war and the immigrants, our infrastructure hasn't had time to rebuild."
"Then what can Modigan come up with?"
10,000 by July. At the very least, maybe double that."
"I'm no algebraist," Wint said, "but that sounds horrible."
"They'd have to thread their campaign through a narrow needle,"
Varla said softly.
"The Dundans are often snowed in by October."
"And that snow won't fall on whatever hill we huddle on?" Cav countered.
"Why are we arguing whether to help?" Dante said. "We're the reason they're facing invasion. If we hadn't been stirring up trouble the last 5 years, they'd still be just another unhappy territory."
"We," Wint said, "the institution of this council and the higher lord we serve."
Cav gazed at the white plaster ceiling and the chandelier's 12 clusters of candles.
"The key fact is that promise was made 5 years ago. If we were looking at the world as it lies right now, would we make that same promise?"
Which, of course, has nothing to do with the fact we did make that promise, Kali said. Anyway, the thinking here is very all or nothing. There are ways to aid and resist that don't